Produced at CFIS-FM in Prince George, Health First is available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
We have Dr. Jacob Appel with us today. He is a physician, a psychiatrist, an attorney, a bioethicist, and he has written a book called, it says, Who Says You're Dead? So welcome, Dr. Jacob Appel. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
What caused you to write a book? This is very interesting. It's like so many little short stories and ethical dilemmas. How did you come about writing it?
Sure. So I've taught bioethics for about 20 years now at various universities, now at Mount Sinai at a medical school. And it's always struck me that I teach the medical students about these issues, but the people who really need to learn about them are lay people, people who will be patients, people who will be decision makers. So I tried to create a book that is both informative but also entertaining. So the examples I use come from pop culture and entertainment and history rather than just from a clinic.
Yeah, well, it is both. It's really very interesting. And there's so many hypothetical things that you bring forward, and then trying to figure out from science, philosophy, history, how do you choose ethics? Where does our structure for ethics actually come from? What do we draw on when we have these dilemmas?
So I don't think for most of the situations, because they're complicated cases, there's a hard and fast rule or a framework to draw upon. I think there are right answers for different people. My concern is more giving people tools to help think about how to come to the right answers for themselves, thinking about the consequences of different choices and the implications of different approaches to problems, and to understand, and I think this is the most important take-home point, that people who disagree with you on these complex questions aren't evil. They're simply people who start with different premises and therefore reach different conclusions. And until you reach that point of understanding, you're never going to be able to persuade other people to share your viewpoint.
And there's so many different perceptions in this day and age. Like we've come a long ways since everybody was trained to think the same way. So there's so many challenges that you're coming up against in it just, this book really helps you to investigate your own values. Was that part of the reason you chose to write it?
Oh, absolutely. I think beyond simply not having like one set of values to fall back on or one set of educational norms and ethics, we really don't have any training in ethics for most people. Bioethics, dealing with medicine, law, and technology, is not part of high school curricula or college curricula. So unless you go out of your way to read a book like this, the first time you confront these issues is often in the hospital. And what I tell people as a professional bioethicist is bioethicists are fun people with fascinating stories. We're great to meet at weddings or at parties. The one place you don't want to meet us is in the hospital. And the best way to avoid that is to think about some of these questions in advance.
Tell us some of your funnest stories to get people going.
Sure. So the first example in the book, and one that's near and dear to my heart, is the example of a patient who brings his daughter to see if the daughter is a potential kidney donor. And it turns out there's bad news and there's worse news. The bad news is that she is not a genetic match to donate a kidney. And the worst news is she's actually not his daughter. And then you raise this complex question, should the hospital tell them? Should the hospital tell him, the daughter? Should the hospital tell neither of them? Because telling them will obviously devastate their family life, or is likely to do so. But if you don't tell them, the daughter will lead life thinking she is the child of someone she isn't and make medical decisions accordingly. She might think that she comes from a long line of Scandinavians and not get tested when she has children for diseases that affect only Ashkenazi Jews and then end up having a baby who has Tay-Sachs. Or she might come into a clinic and they'll ask her if she has early onset colon cancer in her family, and she'll say, of course not, so they won't screen her, and then she'll die of cancer.
Wow. So all this DNA testing that's happening, everybody and their all the neighbors, everybody's doing it. Is that throwing a lot of questions out there as well?
Oh, absolutely. The technology is advancing far more quickly than laws advancing or ethics are advancing. The example I always use, I imagine a lot of people listening to your show are either at work or in the car on the way to work. I ask them to ask themselves, did they lock their doors before they came to work? And most of them, if they live in urban areas, suburban areas, will say yes. And then I ask them, did you dust the DNA off your doorknobs before you got in the car? And nobody does. But in many jurisdictions, somebody perfectly legally can scrape the DNA off your doorknob. They can do some genetic testing on this. They can find out your father's not your father or what diseases you're susceptible to. They can tell your employer. They can tell your partner. They can wreak havoc in your life. And in many places, they can do so with impunity. So that's something worth thinking about.
Wow. And how much weight do we put in that, like diseases that we might get? Is there's still a lot of choices about how we deal with our health and our life so that we don't come down with those things that we're genetically predisposed to?
So we do have some control over our health, and we can certainly, and we should, to the degree we can, lead healthy lives. But some things are genetically predetermined or genetically likely. And one of the more challenging questions now is to what degree people want to know the risk if there's nothing they can do about it, and to what degree they want to impose that knowledge upon other people. The one particular dilemma is you can get testing now for something called APOE genes, which will give you some sense of your likelihood of developing Alzheimer's in old age. But there's nothing you can do that we know to prevent that if you have one of these higher likelihood genes. What's more concerning is that when you reveal your own data, you actually reveal to some degree the risk of your parents as well, whether they want to know or they don't. So the question arises, should you be able to do that? And if you find the information out, do you have some obligation to share it with them?
And, yeah, wow. And also, what about insurance companies? Say I go to get this test and I realize, okay, I'm totally up for Alzheimer's. And is it ethical for me to run and get long-term disability and all those things and get them in line knowing that?
Well, you can try, but as I tell people, at least in the United States, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act only protects you from discrimination based on genetics in a few very narrow areas, like working for a large employer or getting health insurance. So since you mentioned long-term care insurance isn't covered. Your long-term care insurer can ask you whether you've sent your DNA away, and if you lie, they can then not pay out, and if you tell them the truth, they can ask for the results. So there may be a downside to getting this information that you don't even know about.
So we may be better off to run life without knowing and just do our best.
You know, absolutely. Some people want to know, some people don't want to know. It's one of those mysteries.
And is there a possibility we could get our DNA tested and use a different name?
There are many options out there, let's put it that way.
Yeah, you kind of don't want that trailing you. How about, let's look at all these. Do you have assisted suicide in you're from California?
I'm not from California. I'm from New York.
New York. Is that happening down there as well?
No, it's not legal in New York State. Aiding and dying is now legal in a handful of states, but not New York. But it raises all sorts of complex ethical questions about how strong your wish has to be, how long-standing your wish has to be, in the same way that's for all other medical decision-making. So one of the examples I always use is, let's say that you want to opt out of medical care for religious reasons. We generally let you do that. But what if you were a lifelong Methodist your entire life, and the patient in the bed next to you convinced you to become a Christian Scientist, and you now suddenly believe in prayer and not antibiotics? How long and strong does your view have to be held for us to honor?
Interesting. And for those who are up against cancer and all sorts of very, very expensive, when the expense of the treatment and the prognosis is very short, how do you decide who should get these very expensive treatments? And is it okay for us to just say, no thanks, we all die sometime? How do you choose those things?
Well, I think historically in medicine and bioethics, one of the challenges is what to do when families didn't want more care and the state or society or religious values tried to impose them upon people. But in the U.S., at least, we've now reached the opposite position, where some people want more care than we're willing or able to provide for them. So, for example, in one case in the early 2000s, a retired prison guard in North Carolina had a rare disease that cost over $5 million a month to treat. And while treated, he did quite well. But the question arose, if he lived a year, that's $60 million in healthcare costs. That's an extraordinarily large number of flu shots or mammograms or Alzheimer's research. Should we be spending money like that? The analogy I always use is in the first year of the Ice Bucket Challenge to raise money for ALS, the entire value raised is $100 million. $60 million on one patient, that's a lot of money.
So in your area, do they actually have a ceiling on how much life is worth then underneath the medical care?
Generally, no. In our practice suits and in wrongful death suits here, county, we do put a price tag on life. Life is not priceless in the courts, even though it may be to us personally. But in the medical setting, we generally don't.
And do we have, you know, at big hospitals, do we actually have a board of doctors that will get together and discuss this? Or is it up to one human to make our life choice for us?
So one of the good things about at least the American system, and generally in the Western world, is that rarely do these decisions fall to one person. Rather, we have hospital ethics committees for the very high-stakes cases with experts from all the medical fields, surgery, medicine, psychiatry, pediatrics, but also from other clinical fields like nursing, social work. We have a lawyer. We have often a clergy who all weigh in, and we try to reach a consensus opinion, not just so the weight doesn't fall on one person, but also so we get as many perspectives as possible.
That's good. What can we do just as single human beings, like living wills? What do we need to do to make things as easy as possible if we get into these situations?
So it always helps to do documentation, to have written down what you want done in certain circumstances, to have a living will or a healthcare proxy. And I add, if you have an advanced directive, you want to know where it is and you want your decision maker to know where it is. Because I often teach adult ed classes and I ask people, where is your living will? And they say, in my safe deposit box. And I remind them that if you're incapacitated, your loved ones may not have access to your safe deposit box. But beyond that, I think the most important thing is to sit down with your loved ones. And obviously, you can't cover every possibility, but to discuss your general values about end-of-life care, about emergent care, about heroic efforts, so at least they know where you stand. Because what you want to avoid is when people are already under the stress and the pressures of you being gravely ill or even possibly dying, the added conflict of not knowing what you want done. The last thing you want is two sisters, one of whom thinks that you would want everything done and the other one thinks you would want to die a natural death.
So it might be good to actually tape this conversation so we can replay it with family.
I mean, that would be ideal in some circumstances, but I think most of the time people act in good faith. Rarely, once people come forward and say, this is what my loved one wants, is there any challenge to it? It's people simply don't know. I can't tell you when I was a consult psychiatrist how many times I would call a healthcare proxy and say, your cousin Fred is in very bad shape and we need you to come in and make some decisions. And the person would say, cousin Fred never told me he was a healthcare proxy. I don't want to do that.
So lack of communication in the family can be a big one.
Oh, absolutely. And all of that is easily preventable. Most of us have a loved one who would be glad to do this if we sat down in advance and explained to them what was involved.
How do we create that kind of conversation around the Sunday dinner table?
Well, I think the most important thing is you want to do it in a situation which is low stress. You don't want to do it in a situation when there's some crisis going on. Family doctors and outpatient providers can be very helpful in doing this. They can sit down with you and say, here are the things you might want to think about when you go home. Sit down with your spouse, your children, talk about them. And it should be an ongoing conversation. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book is rather than people simply discussing this once and never thinking about it again, I want people to think about these questions on a fairly regular basis.
So just like you might take your cat to the vet once a year, you should have these discussions once a year.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We think about all the other things we do to protect ourselves in dangerous situations, but there are a few crises that affect us more than end-of-life decision-making or catastrophic illness, and we try not to think about them on a regular basis. It's a mistake.
You kind of want to put them away, have the discussion and put it away and just live. If you get a hold of somebody and you say that's the healthcare proxy, and they say they don't want that position, what happens?
So in the United States, at least, we often can find a backup decision maker, either someone appointed one or they have a close relative who will stand in. But again, that's usually someone who the patient has never discussed their wishes with in advance, and there's a lot of guesswork involved. We try, in the U.S. and in most of the Western world, we try to do what the patient would have wanted done, but if the patient hasn't told someone, that's often a lot of speculation.
Okay. And with... I guess with families and documentation and getting this all written up carefully, have you seen it where it works with getting the whole family together, or is it best just to deal with that one person who's really going to take care of it?
I think the two are not mutually exclusive. I think you want to have one person or two people who really know what you want done, who know where your documents are, who know what your values are. And then you probably want to let other people who will be vested in that decision at least have some sense of who you want making the decisions and why, and what your general parameters or values are. I mean, you don't have to do this every Sunday. This doesn't have to be a morbid, ongoing conversation.
No.
but it should be something that is not completely distant from your mind.
Wonderful. Okay, Jacob, we're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about your book, Who Says You're Dead?